Ladies and gentlemen, we are live, the Sean Steele Law Firm podcast. We are sans Sean Steele at the moment. He may be joining us remotely, live from somewhere in the middle of the heartland of the country. He is on a pilgrimage, tracking where his ancestors fought in the Civil War from Tennessee down into Kentucky, because that's where you'd want to be in the middle of August, is in some battlefield in Kentucky. But nevertheless, that's where Sean is. I'm here at the law firm, and with me is the ever famous, the well-known, the insufferable, Dr. Dan Murphy.
Hi, everyone.
Doctor, thank you for being with us. I know that that the people who have tuned in today are very excited to hear from you, and that your reputation precedes you. We had several people prior to today write in asking specifically when you would be speaking. So here you are, live and in the flesh, coming to us from what I was calling off the record a professor's office, it looks like. And you are a professor, right? You teach at Life West.
Yes, I do.
What do you teach there?
I teach a class to seniors on the management of spinal disorders dovetailed around neurology and pathology. Seems like they would be not fitting together, but they do. And so my actual job at the college is to take everything they've learned in every class and show them how it is integrated. So, you know, toxicology, biomechanics, neurology, orthopedics, just about everything you can think of, I tend to integrate it into a interactive drawing class. It's the most unique thing in the history of chiropractic. It sounds pretty ego, but it's the truth, that I figure out how to engage their cerebellum, that we draw pictures, and some of the homework that I get should be in frames and in the Smithsonian Museum. They're so fabulous. But when you do an interactive drawing class, the result is you engage the cerebellum, which is the key to everything. There's more neurons in the cerebellum than the rest of the body combined, which is an interesting talk when we're talking PI today, and that I do this for my court cases. I showed them two of the three drawings that I do in a typical court case Monday this week. I started the third, I only do three. I started the third drawing, but we still have a few more hours to complete it. But every line, there's logic, every line, there's supportive studies, and just try to putting it all together so that lay people can have a better understanding why a chiropractor would treat PI. What are our clinical goals? What are we looking for in terms of outcomes? And then, of course, we talk about using measurement outcomes and what it can do for a case. The PI people that I deal with mostly, I deal with this one law firm, and their guy, a guy named Richard, he says that a case that is worth literally $100,000 may be dialed down to $2,000 if the chiropractor has bad record keeping. So we talk a lot about, okay, what should the records have in them? And it's like, you can't spend 30 minutes making records. We got to do things quick. I mean, we're busy. We got to process a certain number of people. So what are really should we do? When I would hustle a PI attorney, pretty much what I would bring is my records to show a case, say, this is the way we do it. How often we do re-evals, what our re-eval reports look like. And then we talk to them about the narrative report at the end of the case. You know, what would we try to put in there so that the attorney has, pretty good information. The last one I did, by the way, pretty recent. They came back with $180,000. This chiropractic PI. It's not, don't need surgery, don't need $180,000. These are good numbers, but it's good numbers because we sort of know what we're doing. And that's a little bit of what I get to share with the audience that's listening before Sean shows up. And if it's okay with you, I thought I would just start with two questions. And then at the end, we'll answer the two questions. Is that all right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I was going to have you start sort of 30,000 feet and get into the weeds. And it sounds like that's a little bit of exactly what you're going to do. So what are your two? Sounds like you're going to be the questioner and the questionee today.
Well, I will. I'll ask the question to the audience. And then at the end, I'll answer the questions. And they're good. And the audience may know who Marilyn Vos Savant is. Her fame is that it is claimed that she has the highest IQ on planet Earth at this moment. You know, pretty close between her and Sean Steele, but she's getting the edge, at least right now. And Marilyn Vos Savant has a newspaper column. And I read the column. I always look forward to it because people ask her questions. Recently, two questions involved personal injury. Here they are. So the first one is, someone writes in to Marilyn Vos Savant, how many Americans have died from car accidents since the invention of the automobile? And how does this compare to the number who have died in wars? So PI death versus war death. And her response, very interesting. The other one is kind of what I would do in a PI postgrad class or even my undergrad class. Here it is. It came out last year. This question was posed to Marilyn Vos Savant. It says, say you're sitting at a red light. In your rearview mirror, you see the car behind you can't stop in time. Knowing you're going to be rear-ended, what should you do? Some people say you should brace yourself. Others say you should relax as much as possible. Which is better? Okay, then she answers that.
Great.
So pretty important stuff. And just as we just say hi for a moment, did anyone read today's paper? Now, I try to read 5 newspapers a day. I read the Sacramento Bee. Of the 5 papers I read today, only one had this article. It came in the SAC B is referencing the Associated Press, and it just flat out says, pandemic, this is the title of the article, pandemic set off deadly rise in speeding that hasn't stopped. What the article details from the National Transportation Safety Board is that fatalities from PI cases in 2020 went up 7.2% compared to the prior year. They blame it on the fact that with the COVID lockdowns, more people working at home rather than going to the job, the roads are more empty, allowing people that are on the roads to put the pedal to the metal and to bring up their speed.
And that's exactly what we've borne that out we had more cases. We were talking about this just recently, more cases in that lockdown time in 2020, like March to May period, where everybody was truly locked down. The cases we got during that time, we had more over 100 mile an hour collisions, excess of 100 mile an hour collisions than we'd ever had in the history of the law firm in that 3-month span.
In that regard, that's somewhat mentioned here. It says in California, where you and I both are, it says in California, the number of people going over 100 miles per hour doubled in that same time frame. It doubled. So you're just thinking, and they blame it on the fact that there's not enough cars on the road to slow people down.
Right.
And the other thing is, they say as a consequence of what's happening in law enforcement, there are not enough officers to do enforcement. The result is chances of being caught are very, very low. Nobody's on the road to slow down the flow. So people are just going like crazy. The result is more deaths and, in fact, more injuries. So I thought all of that was pretty interesting. And that's today's paper. It just came out today. If you dial that back to USA Today, this is the SAC B, USA Today on my birthday, January 29th of 2021, there's a similar study saying, man, it's just going crazy out there because of excessive speed.
Yeah.
Says the number of people going over 100 and getting their wrecks is just unbelievable. Yeah. And it flat out says, this is a quote from an article, says, a crash that is easily survivable at 40 miles per hour is often fatal at 50 miles per hour or more.
Wow.
So that you're taking more types of events that would have been injurious and actually pushing them into your death. And I'm thinking, God, that's an interesting comment. And then the other kind of related comment is USA Today in February of this year, 2021, also published a study, a little bit sexist, about vehicle size. And it flat out says, the smaller the car, the greater the risk of the occupants of the car from being both injured and killed. They say size actually matters in injury, and you want to have a bigger car as possible. The sexism is that if I look at the headline, it says smaller cars means more injuries for women. And what they the way they do it is say just statistically is that more women drive smaller cars than men. So the result is it's another reason that women have a greater exposure. And they've known forever. They've known at least since the Vralt study that came out of Archives of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation all back in 1998, that women have a smaller cross-sectional diameter. If you put them in the same accident as a man, smaller cross-sectional diameters of soft tissues increases the risk of injury. Women tend to get double the injury rate and injury extent as compared to men in the exact same motor vehicle event. So just women, you know, just some things to talk about. But all of that is probably secondary to, I thought this would be, you know, so I'm thinking, okay, what has really made a difference in my understanding of PI? And again, the way my life has gone, I've done about 15,000 PI cases. I've done hundreds, literally, of depositions on PI, and I've done 33 trials. I think maybe now 34. I just recently did another 34 trials, and some we got our butts kicked. Some we did a lot better. We kind of learned, you know, what, you know, a bad way and a good way. I mean, one of the things I figured out real quick is that my education, I got out of chiropractic college thinking that what chiropractors were doing was unpinching pinched nerves. And that's for most often stupid talk. And it's very easy to show that that's stupid talk. And if you're doing that, it kind of, you know, puts a target on you as being an idiot. So what are we doing? And so I think my real claim to fame started in the summer of 1997, where I did a case and I explained how chiropractic adjustments activate the suprasegmental descending pain inhibitory control pathway. And so that really went over well. I mean, we've done it pretty much on all the cases that I've done since 1997. It's what I started doing with my 12 quarters unit class at the college, Left Chiropractic College West, Monday of this week. I'll finish it Monday coming up. And it's remote, so I'm doing all of this stuff remote. But part of what I would just make sure everyone understands that if you read the whiplash literature, there is absolute best journals claiming that the number one predictor of injury and chronicity from injury is state of preparedness at the moment of the collision. And they've known for decades and decades that vehicular damage is irrelevant. But what is relevant is state of awareness, so that people a lot of times say, how bad was the car beat up? But if instead we ask, okay, were you caught by surprise or not? Because that is a huge deal. Just as a metaphor, I speak to my wrist. I go, wrist, get ready. You're going to get a whiplash. And so the wrist knows it. It's told it. So you jerk it around. And am I injuring my wrist? No, because it's prepared. To take a saying from my friend Malik Slosberg, joints fail when muscles don't protect them adequately. My muscles are protecting the joint. There's no injury. But if I disengage the muscles and I start bouncing off my ligaments, I'm going to have trouble working later today and tomorrow. The metaphor is when people are caught by surprise, the muscles do not protect them. The forces goes to the joint. And that's when you get chronicity. Chronic whiplash pain is articular. If you look at that study by Nikolai Bogduck that came out in the journal Spine in December of 2011, Bogduck, the number one clinical anatomist of all recorded human history, he is adamant chronic whiplash is facetal. And the facet joint capsules are injured when the muscles don't protect them. And therefore, the awareness factor is a really big factor. So we talk, you know, it's in our paperwork. You know, we ask people, will you cop a surprise or not? Now look at some of the, like, the one case, I did a case at the college. I literally did it at the college, a PI case, where this young guy was looking maximum left when he's rear-ended and he gets an injury. But we just say, how bad was the car damage? Not bad, couple hundred dollar dent in the bumper. But yet we justified a $1,400 chiropractic bill because He was maximum rotated, which is a problem, and then hit from behind, caught by surprise. We know that when the head's rotated, the intervertebral foramen is smaller on the side of rotation, giving it a greater vulnerability, a smaller margin of safety. If you're caught by surprise, then that's when you get the injury. So we just talked it up. It went to trial and we talked it up. We did a good job. We did a templating of the x-rays. The jury liked the templating of x-ray, the pulling of the jurors after. They said, yeah, that templating stuff, because it's a completely objective finding to show soft tissue injury, worked really, really well. But just the understanding about the being caught by surprise, I thought was a really big deal.
And anecdotally, I'm sure we've all heard stories of, I mean, I know one in particular that stands out in my mind of the guy that was in a tornado and he got thrown like, I don't know, 1,000 feet or 100 yards, really far. And he was knocked unconscious before he landed, and they credit his surviving this huge fall from him having been limp and relaxed at the time of the fall. And I've heard other anecdotal evidence of people claiming that because they were caught by surprise, because they were relaxed at the time of an impact, that they had a better outcome. So how do we explain, or is that just anecdotal, you know, statistics?
Yeah, those are anecdotes. They're incorrect. The studies that I use, the first study is the Sturzenegger study. Sounds like Schwarzenegger. The Sturzenegger study came out of the journal Neurology, filed under N, not under J. It came out in April of 1994. It's a 137-person study. They're looking at them in the short run. They're looking at them with a one-year follow-up. Who got the worst injury and who had the worst and the best outcome? Worst on all cases were being caught by surprise. That the people that were aware, they get sore, but they tend to recover completely. Those that were caught by surprise did not do very well at all. This was reiterated in quite a number of studies. The journal Trauma did it by a guy named Ryan later in that decade. In the more recent era, you have the journals PET and SPECT in Neurology by a guy named Garcia. Garcia did it again. He says the entire issue of awareness is the number one issue in terms of prognosis. The anecdotes that you hear, other than your tornado anecdotes, because I don't know them too much, is that when the drunk wipes out the family. But if you actually look at the statistics, they say that it is more likely that the family wipes out the drunk. But that's not headline news. So it tends not to be even published. But when drunk wipes out family, they make it, you know, that's the front page of the paper. But in reality, the drunk, he gets a greater injury. He's more at risk of poor recovery because he was, in fact, relaxed. All of this is reiterated in a brand new book, relatively new, 2017, coming out of UC Berkeley by a guy named Matthew Walker. It's titled Why We Sleep. And he talks about when that falling asleep at the wheel is even worse than drunk driving, because drunks tend to be slow in reaction, but they still react. They're just slow.
When you're sleeping.
When you have what they call a mini sleep, there's no reaction at all. It's kind of like what Tiger Woods just did. The evidence is that he fell asleep at the wheel. He went right through the lane of traffic in the opposite direction. Luckily, he didn't get hit on and goes down the cliff before there's any signs at all that he was breaking. And he got hurt really bad. He shattered his leg. He messed up. But they say, therefore, that even worse than drunk driving is, in fact, falling asleep driving. So if you pick up that book by Matthew Walker, great book, particularly if you're into PI, great book. And same bottom line, being caught by surprise is not a good thing for the patient.
So Dr. Murphy, I want to get into a little bit of giving the people who are listening here, and there's quite a few of them actually, some solid take-home advice. And I think that's a great piece of it. But you have a very unique perspective as a chiropractor who's done that much trial work. So you've seen the litigation process really up close and personal in a way that most chiropractors, I would argue, never do. Give us some pointers, give us some tips, give us some, hey, I see a chiropractor doing this, or I see a chiropractic records that they wrote that. This really plays well in trial, or I see chiropractors get reamed because they do this or that in their reporting or in their treatment. Give us some solid, you know, useful, that sort of stuff.
Well, for sure. And I know, again, it sounds kind of ego, but my experiences are extensive, it's no doubt.
Right.
I'm the real deal, the product of the School of Hard Knocks. I've had great successes and great failures. And you learn from those failures. Last week, I drove through Bakersfield, California. Michelle, my partner here, had to pick up an adjusting table in her garage down in Phoenix. So we went down and we drove back and went through Bakersfield. My first major case was the Bakersfield case. I mean, it went for 1.13 million on a guy. It's a very interesting case, but this is kind of the advice that I would tell people. The first thing is that I have found invaluable, including the case I just did for $180,000, what they came back with. You have to use measurement outcome. Measurement outcome to me is critical because it justifies the care that you're delivering. Plus, it gives the chiropractor and the patient and the carrier and the lawyer, everyone involved, an idea as to when the patient is reaching maximum improvement. When measurement outcomes aren't changing, that's when you should probably call the case and rate the residuals. And essentially, that's what I did in the case. The measurement outcomes that I like best, just for simplicity, is the functional rating index. It was validated in the journal Spine back in 2001. And it is an amalgamation of the Oswestry for low back and the neck disability index for neck. Instead of having people do 20 questions, they amalgamated them to a core 10 so that people only have to do 10 and it's easier for the provider to score. And we figured out, okay, so measuring outcomes is a big deal. The next thing is that I think that you get yourself into trouble if you don't do regular reevals. Our system is set up that we do a reeval every 12 visits. So if it's three times a week, then we're doing them once a month. If it's twice a week, it's every 6 weeks. But if it's daily care, roughly every other week, we're doing a reeval. And then, so we go through our reevals, and then at the end of the reeval, we quickly cut a one-page report. The one-page report goes to all interested people. It goes to the attorney. It goes to the primary care provider. It goes to whoever else is involved in the case, the dentist who's doing the TMJ, whatever. So that we kind of keep track of exactly how well people are doing and what's being stubborn, et cetera. And then kind of putting it all together like that. And then if you go all the way back to the 50s, so we're talking, more than a half a century ago, 70 years ago, you start realizing that the best studies historically in whiplash are claiming that an acutely injured whiplash patient needs daily care. And that anything less than daily care, you will ruin the outcome. Now, carriers don't want to hear that. IME people don't want to hear that, but it's in the literature. So we put people on daily care, but all of a sudden that puts a crimp in the chiropractor. How do you do daily care if you're the only one in the office? So what I tell the students at the college, chiropractic is very intense. To me, it's a very intense thing. So I tell them, and I believe my heart, chiropractic should only work 3 days a week. That means if you're doing Monday, Wednesday, Friday, someone else should work Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. And so you have two chiropractors in the office. We give them a Sunday off. But that way, anyone that needs daily care is, in fact, covered by the clinic. And even that's for acute care. And again, this is the billing study from the International Journal of Trauma coming out in 1953. There's the Salit study out of the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1958. These guys go over the value of daily care to optimize the outcome and to minimize the fibrosis of repair, which is what I got to talk at the WAVE last week to minimize that. And then if you look at the Kirkcaldy-Willis study, the William H. Kirkcaldy-Willis study coming out of Canadian Family Physician, March of 1985, it's on chronics because we do get chronic whiplash. People that have screwed around thinking it would self-resolve and it didn't, time we get them, they're already chronic. He makes the same claim on chronic. He says, if you do not commit to adjusting the patient every day for the first 2 to 3 weeks, you will not get the best outcome. So we use these things and we justify, the care that we would give people, and we get really, really good outcomes. I would also tell everyone, if you get into the PI thing, the guy that invented the word whiplash, a guy named Harold Crow, orthopedic surgeon, he did it actually in the year 1927, the birth year of my mother. And he did it in San Francisco, California, at an orthopedic conference, of all things. If you follow Harold Crow, he wrote an article in the journal California Medicine in 1964, people should read that article, because he says that he and his group who do whiplash figured out the primary cause of chronic whiplash. And he says, don't do this, and the incidence of chronicity will drop like a rock. And so we figured that out decades ago. And the result is we have very few, you know, chronics. And then understanding more of the law. Sean comes up and I'm blessed that he will come up and speak to my seniors. He would have done it this quarter, except for we're remote again, which is just crazy. And it's not on the college, it's on the government. Alameda County Health Department has made it so that our classes are remote. And so it's pretty rough. Or Sean had been up there, did it. But that there's certain legal concepts that providers, I think, have to know about, or they can actually harm the case. Even if you're a good chiropractor, you can harm the case because you don't know certain legal concepts. And so we go over things like the difference between apportionment and an active versus an inactive problem, you know, pre-event degenerative joint disease versus degenerative joint disease caused or accelerated by an accident, just making sure that we're very, very clear and good thinking and all of that stuff. And then the ability to draw pictures to explain chiropractic. What are you doing? Why is the patient seeing you? What are your clinical outcomes? And if I get a chance to do that, I always very politely say to the judge, is it okay to draw? I've never had one say no. Yeah. And so I get up there and I'm right in front of the jury. I remember one time as I stand up here, I'm doing it, and the judge yelled at me as I was drawing these pictures. And I go, yes. He goes, can't see what you're doing. So he judged right away. I mean, my bottom was between him, because I was, you know, going to the jury, but he was behind.
Right.
And I said, so I had to kind of shift around because he was really interested in it too. And that makes a huge difference when you draw pictures, particularly if you do it on a flip chart, because then you can mark it as an exhibit. And then when the jurors are deliberating, which can be days later, you can pull them back out. Yep. If you put on a chalkboard or a whiteboard, trust me, man, they erase those as quick as you can blink an eye.
I always, when I'm in trial with those, I always take pictures of them and then print the pictures and introduce them.
Perfect.
Same concept.
Yeah.
We have 3 minutes left, believe it or not. Okay. We've had so much fun. We have 3 minutes left. And I want you to tell everybody the answers to the questions you posed at the beginning.
Okay. So, and that's exactly what we should do. First question. How many Americans have died from car accidents since the invention of the automobile? How does this compare with the number who have died in wars? The answer, this is her words, so I'm quoting this quote. The comparison is stunning. Since the start of the revolution in 1775, about 1 million Americans have died in wars. Since Henry Ford introduced the mass-produced motor car in 1913, more than 2.5 million Americans have met their deaths on the road. So way 2.5 times more on the road versus wars. And the war went all the way back to 1775. And the car, she started in 1913, hundreds of years later. I'm thinking, wow, cars are dangerous. And then the other one, this one I thought was pretty important, because this is a lot of what I do when I do PI class. You're sitting at a red light and you're rearview mirror, you see the car behind you can't stop in time. Knowing that you're going to be rear-ended, what should you do? Some people say you should brace yourself. Others say you should relax as much as possible, kind of the tornado metaphor that you brought up. Which is better? Her answer. You should brace yourself. Use your muscles to protect the vertebra, the disc, and the nerves in your spine and neck as much as you can. Lean your head against the headrest and face directly forward. In other words, no rotation. Then push your foot against the brake pedal and your back against the seat, if possible, and hold onto the steering wheel. So she wants you to tighten your muscles to protect the joints. She wants there to be no gap at all between you and the back of the seat and the head restraint. She wants you to look straight forward, no rotation at all. And interestingly, she wants you to put your foot on the brake, because the inertial acceleration difference between the head and the trunk entering the neck are linked to the acceleration achieved by the struck vehicle. If the foot's on the brake, the vehicle doesn't accelerate as much. This, by the way, is flawlessly done. Absolutely the best I've ever seen it in The Spine by Rothman and Simone, volume 2, chapter 10, page 648. They go over the best explanation why you should put your foot on the brake, because it reduces the forward acceleration of the vehicle, proportionally reducing the inertial acceleration differences between the different parts of a person's body that otherwise would be injured. She said it flawlessly.
That is counterintuitive. You would think you'd want that to absorb some of the impact. That might be the biggest take home of the day. It is 1:30. I want to get these docs out of here so they can get back to their normally scheduled content. But Dr. I think I should call you Professor. Professor Murphy, after that lecture.
No. You know, I'm Dan Murphy. I'm a chiropractor. Let's face it.
You were quoting line and verse out of The Spine written by a guy in the year. That was incredible. Alone.
Yeah. Well, just because you don't listen to me, those that are on this audience that listen to me know I have a unique skill set. You should see what I can do.
I truly believe it. I feel badly for your wife. Dr. Murphy, Professor Murphy, Dan Murphy, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast, on the live stream today. I know that everybody appreciates it very much. How, if they want to, can people get in touch with you if they so choose?
Well, they would get a hold of Michelle. Michelle is michelle@danmurphydc.com.
Great. Great. If anybody has questions for Dr. Murphy, they can reach out to Michelle that way and get a hold of you. As everybody knows, they can get a hold of me and Sean through our website, seansteele.com. Sean's email is the easiest in the world, seansteele@seansteele.com. Mine's slightly more complicated, alexandereisner@seansteele.com. Our podcast will be up on iTunes, Google, everywhere you get podcasts. And this the video will be up on YouTube within a couple of days. Again, Dr. Murphy, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.